This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 239 was recorded October 1st, 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases, and by FarmTogether.com, bringing farmland, a new trillion-dollar investment opportunity, within reach of all accredited investors. When I interviewed petroleum geologist Art Berman back in June, Art told us to expect U.S. oil production to fall off a cliff in Q4. Well, today is the first day of Q4, and it's no coincidence that we're bringing Art back for an update on his outlook on the oil market. We'll discuss what's changed and what hasn't changed since Art's last interview back in June. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick will present another of his famous post-game chart books, this one evaluating whether the reflation trade has ended or not.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into that S&P 500. I mean, more or less, we can define the last week as the market bouncing. We've obviously put some sort of a short-term swing low in the markets, and we've been retracing towards this 3,400 level. What's your take on all of this? Is there more upside, or is this it for this little rally?
I have no idea, Patrick. I certainly do agree that it's very likely, you know, described as a bounce as opposed to necessarily a trend reversal. It was a perfect touch of the 100-day moving average, which is a key technical level. A lot of people, you know, bought that thinking it might be the bottom. We're bouncing. Has it gone far enough to begin a new trend? No. Have we seen any sign of it reversing back to the downside? Not yet. So I don't think we know what's going on. As far as the big picture, you know, I think that we're definitely in for some volatility by year end in one direction or the other, driven by what I think is almost an assured contested election. On the other hand, everybody knows it's an assured contested election, which means that maybe it's already priced in. And of course, we don't know what's priced in. Is it the downside potential of uncertainty as not knowing who's president, or is it the upside potential of near certain accommodation from the Federal Reserve in reaction to whatever might go wrong? So I don't think we know. I think we're going to have to wait and find out.
All right, well, let's move on to the dollar index, because we had the breakout last week, and this week we're giving a little bit of it back, but we're still more or less hovering a stone's throw away from the 94 handle. What's your take on the dollar here?
I wish I had a stronger take with more conviction. I can tell you with absolutely firm conviction, this is the most important issue that there is in macro. If you can figure out what the dollar is going to do next, you've got serious edge over the market. Do I have that edge? Nope, afraid not. The contested election and the Fed stimulus response are clearly a bearish setup. If we don't know who the president of the United States is, the rest of the world starts to lose confidence in the U.S. dollar. And if that situation ensues, it's pretty certain we're going to get more stimulus from the Fed. That greater stimulus from the Fed is, of course, dilutive to the value of the dollar. There's lots of reasons to think down. On the other hand, if things really get crazy in the wake of a contested election and that spreads globally, well, then you've got a flight to safety trade. And I put safety in air quotes. A lot of people still think the U.S. dollar is the safest currency on earth. I think gold is a safer bet myself, but a lot of institutional finance people don't think that way. So, you know, if there's a flight to safety trade, that's potentially bullish for the dollar. And of course, you've also got the dollar squeeze argument that Jeff Snyder has made so eloquently. I really don't know what to say. So if I don't know how to interpret the fundamentals, let's look at technicals. Well, technicals, you could argue that Friday's high was a new higher high in the short-term trend that began at the end of September. or you could go the other way and say it's a fresh lower high on the larger, longer-term trend that goes back to June. So the jury is still out on my mind, and frankly, I think you'd need a daily close above 95 or below 92 in order to get a really clear technical signal of which way we're headed next. So jury's still out. I think we have to wait and see.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because had a big downdraft today. I mean, at one point, we were down under $38. We're back above there at the time of recording. What's going on here in crude?
Well, I'm going to save the big picture, what's going on in crude, what does the next year bring us, for the feature interview with Art Berman. So for this week's market wrap, let's just focus on the inventory and short-term outlook, and we'll defer to Art Berman for the long-term outlook. I'll also have more to say in reaction to the interview with Art Berman in our post-game segment after the feature interview. Let's start with inventory. Crude oil drawing down 2 million barrels, plus another 1.8 coming out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, so that total drawdown was 3.8 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma building 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline building 683,000 barrels. Distillates drawing down 3.2 million barrels. U.S. production, which, as we've discussed in the past with Art Berman, and I'll discuss with him again today, that's the thing to watch as we go into Q4. What's it doing this week? Unchanged from last week. 10.7 million barrels, which is also exactly where we were before the tropical storm hit the Gulf of Mexico. As far as what I think is going on, I was really leaning toward there still being more downside in this correction. And that's still my view, but maybe without a huge amount of conviction. The weakness that we saw today was consistent with that. I think if we can get a daily close below the 34-week moving average, which is at 36.12 on WTI, that really is a setup to get us down to the target that I've been looking for the past few weeks, which is somewhere in the low 30s, between $30 and $33 on the WTI front month contract. Now, you know, we've seen more resilience than I expected, and that's been the theme for the last several weeks. Are we going to see a change in terms of weakening demand hitting the tape first, which probably get us down to that $30 number? Or are we going to see a decline in U.S. production hit the tape first, which might take us higher and lock us out of ever getting down to that $30 number anytime soon? I'm not sure. It kind of depends on timing. Let's wait and see what Art Berman has to say in the feature interview about what we can expect in terms of timing for that reduction of U.S. production to occur.
Right. So let's move on to gold, because gold has last week corrected down towards the 1850 level. And really this week, we've just had a bounce off of those lows. I mean, we're back above 1900 here on the bounce. What's your take on gold? Is that enough of a correction, or is there more to come?
Well, Patrick, our regular listeners will remember that last week I said I was really hoping for a deeper correction down to 1800 or so, where I've got resting limit orders to buy more gold. But I also offered a caution, which is that we were just coming up on that 100-day moving average, which just might hold it. Well, clearly, at least so far, it's holding it. Now, is that just a bounce off the 100-day moving average? We're back up to the 13-day, which is, you know, the highest of the short-term moving averages. Is that the top of the bounce, and we're going to end up below that 100-day at 1868. If that happens, a daily close below 1868 would suggest to me that we probably are headed down to that, you know, approximately 1800, maybe even down as low as 1750, which is where the 200-day moving average is. On the other hand, if we get an upside breakout and a daily close above 1950 or so, that would be the technical indication that we've got a new bull trend in play, and we're maybe headed up to test the all-time highs again. So I think 1868, below that number or above 1950, is the place where you see the technical signals that ought to suggest a further move in that direction. Until we get one of those, I'm not sure which way it's headed from here.
All right, Eric, I want to finally touch on this 10-year Treasury yield. I'm actually quite surprised how narrow the range has been in this 10-year yield, because we have stock markets that are buzzing. You have all of the talk of these fiscal stimulus packages, and you have commodities whipping around, the currencies whipping around, and yet the 10-year yield doesn't seem to want to move more than a couple basis points higher or lower, and we're in this tight range hovering around 68 basis points. Like, how do you make sense of all this?
Well, I'll give you my guess, and it's not really strong conviction. I think what's been going on for the last few months is most people are stuck where I am, which is, boy, are we, you know, we've pretty much made the move down to almost zero at one point on the 10-year Treasury. Can it go negative? Are we headed there? Or is the 38-year bond bull market necessarily over? I think everybody's got that question in their mind. Nobody knows the answer. And I think that what we're finding here at around 70 basis points on the 10-year is sort of the sweet spot for everybody to wait this out. And, you know, it's kind of the balance point until we get a clear indication of whether inflation is really going to start to run away, whether we're going to see a backing up in yields associated with that, or if deflation can take us even further into negative yields. And of course, what does the Fed do? What is the, you know, how does the contested election work out? There's a lot of things that the market is waiting for. And I think that it's found a balance point at around 70 basis points. The longer we consolidate in that narrow range, the more the market becomes coiled up and the more we're in a position for a fairly pronounced move when we get one in either direction. Which direction that's going to happen in, frankly, I've got no clue.
Eric, why did we invite Art to the show this week?
Well, as I mentioned in the opening monologue, Patrick, one reason is it's the first day of Q4. Art made a lot of predictions about what would happen to U.S. production in Q4. I want to find out if he still holds those convictions as strongly as he did in June. The other reason, though, is there's a lot that's happened since then that really brings the question to mind is, what if demand drops off even more than production does? So I want to get Art's take on that as well. I think it's a really important time in the oil markets. We've been coiling at this level right around $40 on WTI. I think we're beginning finally an overdue correction to the downside, but I'm not sure how deep it's going to go. At some point, I think there's a lot of upside in this market, but is that really starting in Q4 or does it not really come until 2021? I want to get Art's perspective on when these things that he's predicted since June are really going to start to take hold in the market and be felt in the price of crude oil. Listeners, we know many of you agree with us that we're the best financial podcast on the internet because that's what iTunes and Apple Podcasts used to say about us. Unfortunately, we haven't been reminding you to do those ratings and reviews, which keep us in our number one slot, which we really feel like we deserve. And by the way, that's what helps us get the very best feature guests to come on the program. So your ratings and reviews really do help us to get better feature interviews for your future listening pleasure. Writing a five-star review for Macro Voices is simple. The instructions, step-by-step, are in your Research Roundup email. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In recent weeks, we've been reminded of the fragility of world financial markets and how quickly sentiment can shift from risk on to risk off. Once again, the mantra of buy the dip and the determination of central banks will be put to the test. But as Chris Cole recently told us, the best approach to investing in the long run is very different from what's worked best in recent decades. To help Macro Voices listeners navigate an uncertain future, Niels Kastrup-Larsen, host of the Top Traders Unplugged podcast, has created a guide to the best investment books of all time. You can get a free copy at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup-Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your Research Roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Art Berman is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is petroleum geologist Art Berman. Longtime Macro Voices listeners know it wouldn't be an Art Berman interview without an Art Berman slide deck. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right next to Art's picture. Art, last time we had you on in June, what you told us was the shale patch was going to get through the summer just fine because there was an inventory of drilled but uncompleted wells that could be completed, brought online. Production could probably be held up, was your prediction. And sure enough, that has very much played out. You also told us that the vicious price rally that was still in play when we spoke in June was about to top out. You nailed that call perfectly. It ended up within a week topping out. You said it was probably going to roll over and there would be a downside correction over the course of the summer. I guess that's pretty much played out. It hasn't been as deep of a correction as you and I both expected, but the correction has been there. But what you told us, Art, was put your seatbelt on for Q4, because you said with the rig count depressed, there's just no way that anything else could happen but U.S. production eventually falling off a cliff, probably in Q4. I assure you, Art, it is no coincidence that we brought you back on the very first day of Q4 for an update on that prognosis. So do you still expect U.S. production to fall off a cliff, which of course would be bullish for prices in Q4, or maybe do we need to get worried about demand falling off a cliff too, which would be bearish for prices?
Well, Eric, those are two very important questions, which of course I don't know the answer to, but my data and my sense of history and experience says that the answer to both is probably yes. The demand picture is easier, I suppose, to talk about because we get weekly updates. And I can tell you right now that the demand recovery in the United States it's absolutely stalled. It's been stalled since the beginning of August. And looking at the critical numbers, which we'll discuss later, which are really diesel or distillate and kerosene jet fuel, those numbers continue to go down and are, you know, at a fraction, like maybe 60% of what they ought to be right now. So demand, definitely a problem. As far as the shale patch, you know, you can't produce oil if you don't drill wells. And we are currently at a rig count of 143 in the tight oil horizontal plays as of the end of August. We were at 613 in November of 2019. We're at about a third of what we need to maintain the production that equates to 11 or so million barrels a day U.S., which is what EIA and everybody else forecasts throughout the year. And so the question really is, you know, how many deactivated wells are going to be reactivated, and how do we fill in the gap? I think you called them ducks. That's fine. Call them whatever you will. They're productive wells that are not currently producing. That will keep us going for a while. I said fourth quarter. I never say specifically beginning or end of because I don't know. But my guess is it remains by the end of fourth quarter, or certainly in the fourth quarter, we ought to see production declines. We've already seen them decline. So they will decline more. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it because that's what the data tells me. It's not a story that I'm happy about. It's terrible for every aspect of the United States, its economy in particular. So I'd love to be wrong.
Let's quantify these numbers a little bit more closely, Art, because when you say that by the end of Q4, U.S. production should fall off, perhaps dramatically, how dramatically are we talking about? How big of a number is that in terms of millions of barrels per day of production? And is this something where the likely fall off in demand could maybe balance it out, or is it a bigger production decline than we could ever expect to see demand offset?
Right. Well, certainly U.S. demand, well, it's a little complicated because obviously the U.S. is a big importer of oil. And so there's a simple solution. I mean, the U.S. currently imports, you know, something like 6 million barrels of crude oil a day. So it's not as if our demand is anywhere close to being met by our field production. So that's, you know, that's the way it's been pretty much forever, certainly since 1970. So let's just say, for instance, that demand doesn't fall any further than it has. and production continues to fall as it has, or as I expect that it will, then it's not like there's an emergency or something. We just have to import more oil from Canada, basically, which will make the Canadians very happy. And it won't cost us any more to buy the oil from Canada or Saudi Arabia or someone else than it does to buy from a producer in the Bakken or the Permian Basin. It will send money out of the country, which is not an ideal circumstance. But, we were doing that year after year after year up until about 2011 or 2012, then the Great Recession. The U.S. economy was reasonably okay with all that going on. So bottom line, I fully expect globally that demand will not recover anywhere close to levels that a lot of people think it will. It certainly won't recover as fast as many people think it will, and that will be adequately balanced by a decrease in production, which, markets are not perfect, but they're pretty damn efficient. So as long as the supply-demand balance is in, some sort of slight surplus or slight deficit, everything's fine. Price stays where it is.
Okay, so now you're saying that even though we're going to be forced to import more oil because we're not going to produce it in the U.S., you're saying it's going to cost us the same as if we produced it locally. That seems like a pretty big change from our conversation in June. At that point, we were talking about this phenomenon of U.S. production falling off a cliff, creating a supply-demand imbalance that would, we both thought, push prices substantially higher. It sounds like now you're saying, yeah, the production is definitely still going to fall off a cliff, but maybe between demand falling off and other supplying countries making up for that deficit, probably the bullish price impetus that we thought was coming maybe isn't coming, or is it coming, but just not yet? How do we pull this demand supply equation together and end up with a prognosis of where oil prices might be headed?
Sure. Well, let's go back. It was, almost exactly 3 months ago, I believe, that we talked last. And 3 months ago, I think I said that I was skeptical. Certainly skeptical about a V-shaped recovery in consumption and demand. And I think you pretty much agreed with me on that. But let's face it, 3 months ago, we didn't have any idea what that might look like. And now, 3 months later, I think we have a very clear idea of what that looks like. And what that looks like is demand is not recovering anywhere near as rapidly or as fully as might have been the case, or certainly was a probabilistic case in my mind 3 months ago. So that's changed. We have data that says that. And most importantly, Eric, as I said in the beginning of this discussion, you can look at total petroleum consumption, and that's great, and I do. But as long as diesel is way down, that means that the economy is damaged, because it's diesel that we use to transport goods. Diesel runs trains, diesel runs trucks, diesel runs ships. And if diesel consumption is down, that means people aren't placing orders. Diesel price is relatively insensitive. In other words, if the price of oil goes to $100 and diesel price climbs up along with it, as long as people are placing orders, that's fine. We'll just pass those extra costs along to the consumer. When diesel consumption is low, that only means one thing, and that's the economy is in trouble. So as long as the economy, and of course, jet is a whole other thing, and we all expected jet consumption to be down, because, who the heck wants to get on an airplane even once there's a vaccine? But, jet fuel is something like 8 or 9% of global consumption. And then you start adding in, how many people work in that industry and, in associated industries, travel business. And so that picture is kind of bleak. So the demand side has changed. The other thing we didn't know 3 months ago was how compliant OPEC Plus was going to be on their agreement. Let's remember, You know, there's something like 7 to 10 million barrels per day that's being withheld from the market. And so U.S. production can fall off a cliff, and OPEC alone has plenty of spare capacity to fill that gap. So, you know, I'm not changing the story, I don't think, at all. Believe me, I would gladly change the story if the data told me to. But what has changed, just to summarize, is demand is going to be much lower. And we see now that there is plenty of spare capacity to fill the gap. So that's the way I see things. Will oil price ever get much higher? Sure, it will at some point. But in the near term of the rest of this year and probably certainly the first half, if not all of next year, I would be very surprised to see oil break significantly out of the range boundaries that it's been in now for a couple of months.
Now, when we spoke in June, you expected that at some point, as demand did recover, it would set up a situation where, you know, demand recovers fairly quickly. It's when planes start flying and diesel starts getting consumed and so forth. Of course, the U.S. shale industry would respond to that and the rig count would come up, but there's a delay of several months, and you expected that there was a necessary price spike in oil coming, because at some point demand resumes, drilling resumes, but the completion of wells is lagged by several months. And that means there's an oil price spike. It sounds like you still expect that, but the expectation that we had that it might come as soon as Q4 is really pushed out to the second half of next year. Is that accurate?
Well, it is. And so when we talked last, I showed a graph that is in this slide deck. I believe it's slide number 11 that shows the correlation between the tight oil rig count, which drives all of U.S. production, and the lagged tight oil production. And that lag is something on the order of 10 to 12 months, depending on which play you're specifically talking about. So, you know, the number of wells drilled from a pad, the length of the laterals, the depth to the objective, all that figures in to make it a little bit longer, a little bit shorter for different plays. But since we had that conversation, I have done substantial research to convince myself that empirical fit is in fact legitimate, because it seems like a long time. And 12 months is a huge lag. And so in the deck, looking at slide number 8, what I did here was I went into the database. This is for the Permian Basin. This is for wells drilled in 2019 and 20, and just asked the question, queried the database, what is the time delay between beginning to drill a well, spudding a well, and first oil production? And the answer was about 5 to 6 months. Okay. Looking then at slide number 9, this is a sort of a familiar display by now, which just shows the decline rates. This is, again, the Permian Basin. The decline rates of the what we call the vintage years, the wells that had first production in 2010 versus 11 versus 12, et cetera. And we all know they decline at rapid rates, and those rates seem to increase through time. Great, yada, yada. But then I took that exact same data, and in slide 10, I deconstructed it to see exactly how each one of these vintage years of production increases and decreases. And what I learned from this is that, okay, it takes 5 or 6 months between beginning a well and first production. This slide 10 shows that it takes about 5 or 6 more months before that production builds to a sufficient level to offset the decline of all the rest of the production. So, in fact, something like 12 months is indeed legitimate. If you add to that, that it takes about a month or two to get a rig, once a price signal has told producers, okay, price is high enough, we're talking at least a year here, Eric. And so that's the problem. The problem is that when the rig count is a third of what it needs to be, we could have everybody in the world write oil companies a check tomorrow, and every oil company get on the phone and contract a rig tomorrow, and it would still be a year before there was enough production to make a difference.
Okay, now it's really coming together in my mind, Art. I want to just summarize this and make sure that I've got it right. What I'm hearing you say, if we go back to our conversation in June, we were talking about at some point, we're going to see a resumption of normal demand. And when that happens, with the rig count so low, it's a setup for a price spike to occur in oil. And it sounds like we're still saying that's true, but it's not yet. And what we should look for as investors is when we get to the point where it becomes clear that, okay, the economy is really restarting, we can expect demand to go back to normal or close to normal levels because all the planes are flying again, all the diesel's being consumed again. If we're still looking at rig counts of less than 300, say, then what it tells you is it's going to take the shale industry a year to catch up. And we know that it's not going to take a year for demand to pick back up once it starts picking back up. That's the point where you really expect, okay, now is time to speculatively go long and expect that big move up in price. Once the rig count really recovers back to where it's supposed to be, 600 or 700, that's where you start to say, okay, the industry is about to catch up. Maybe it's time to take profits on that long trade. That whole story doesn't start until sometime next year when we get back to normal demand expectations. Is that a good summary?
That's a perfect summary, Eric. And that, of course, is predicated on the notion that sometime next year, we do, in fact, get back to that level. And I think that is, I certainly hope that is the case. It would be good for everybody's business, including mine, if there were more business. So, you know, I'm sometimes accused of being pessimistic, and that's really not true. If the data tells me that it looks a certain way, that's what I say. But let's keep in mind something very important here, and that is that most of the recovery in oil consumption has been driven by gasoline. And that wasn't meant as a pun. We do drive with it, and that's to be expected because the greatest portion of every barrel of oil is refined into gasoline. But back up a minute and say, well, okay, so where are people getting the money to buy gasoline? And the answer is they're getting money from, in the United States, from unemployment benefits, from, you know, paycheck protection, and all that is going away or has gone away. And it doesn't look to me like anything is going to happen from the U.S. Congress until after this election. And so all of a sudden, those people that were happily filling up their gas tanks and buying goods, let's face it, you know, small goods, consumer spending has recovered more quickly in this recession or depression than in any of the last five, according to, you know, data I've looked at from Pew Research. But let's remember that a lot of that spending has been fueled by checks that come in the mail, and those have stopped. So that's the concern.
Well, I'm going to share my own entirely conjecture-based prediction here, which is, first of all, I think it's probably going to take longer than most people expect before this is over, before we get to the point where the stage is set for demand to really resume. When it starts, I predict it is going to be vicious. I think that when you get people that have been cooped up for 18 months or 2 years or however long it's been at that point, and you tell them that they're allowed to go out and enjoy their liberty again, they're not going to look at the price of gasoline and say, hey, you know, let's not take the first trip that we've ever been allowed to take in the last 2 years because gasoline is $5 a gallon. It's a little expensive. They're not even going to think twice. They're going to say, we're getting the hell out of Dodge. We're going to go enjoy our vacation. And I think you'll see a very, very rapid increase in demand when the conditions permit that increase in demand to occur. And there's just no way that the oil industry will be able to keep up with the pace that demand increase occurs on. And that's where you see the big upward spike in oil prices. Sounds like it's probably the second half of next year at the earliest. And, you know, if there's no vaccine, it could be 5 years. But the longer we wait, my prediction is the bigger and more dramatic that spike in demand becomes.
And I agree with you notionally. Let's take a look at slide number 7, Eric. So this is showing all of the various components of the refined products that come out of a barrel of oil. And so the big stack of columns on the left of center is total product supplied. So you can think about that as total consumption of oil. And what that tells you is that we're at about 55% recovery today. This is as of last week, a week ago today, in fact, Wednesday's storage report. So on the one hand, you know, it kind of looks encouraging. On the other hand, we're only 55% from the low in April or whatever that was compared to the five-year average. So, you know, when we look at the kinds of stuff that gets published in, you know, the mainstream press, they're going to show you, oh, well, gasoline or, you know, oil consumption is at 85 or 90% of normal. What that is 85 or 90% relative to the five-year average. But that's not what's important. What's important is how far have we come from the bottom. And that's what I'm showing here. And that's a much more diagnostic number. Okay, so your argument that I agree with is that people are sick and tired of being at home and they're going to get out and they're going to fill up their cars and they're going to drive. Well, this graph says they're already doing that. Look at gasoline on the left. Gasoline consumption has recovered 83% as of a week ago today. So gasoline consumption is, you know, it's not almost where it needs to be, but it's way ahead of everything else. So they're already doing that to some extent. Diesel, I've already explained why that's so important economically. 60%, it's only 60% recovered. Go down the chart to kerosene jet over near the right, 27%. Now, people, the response, the demand response to making major purchases, I'm not talking about, you know, ordering a new piece of electronics on Amazon. I'm talking about major equipment purchases, durable goods. That is not going to spring right back into action once everything is recovered. I mean, corporations are going to be very cautious about how quickly, I mean, they don't have the same pent-up sort of, you know, angst that consumers do. So I agree with everything you said, but let's be careful. Because as a petroleum geologist, I'm telling you that gasoline is not the only measure, and it's the measure that has the least far to improve. You know, we're at 83%. Before the economy gets rip-roaring, we need to get diesel up from 60. We need to get jet kerosene up from 27.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and disagree with you, Art. When you say it has the least far to go, it sounds like you're assuming from 83% that you've only got 17% to get as far as you can go. That's, I assume, 100% is previous, before the crisis numbers. I think you're going to see a boom in travel and consumption, discretionary consumption of everything. When people get unlocked and let out of prison, so to speak, I don't think we go back to 100%. I think we go back to, I don't know what the number is, but 100 and something percent.
Well, that's, you know, 100% is again, the difference between the low and the five-year average. So we might go above the five-year average for, you know, a certain amount of time, you know, a couple of months, maybe 6 months, whatever. But, you know, in the course of the year, the five-year average is what it is, and it's going to average out as things always do. So, you know, I'm going to disagree with you there, Eric. I don't think that, you know, maybe people start driving like crazy. I would be very surprised if people start traveling like crazy. I mean, there was a very good article, I can't remember, I think it was in the New York Times Sunday edition by Tomas Puello. This is the guy that, you know, wrote The Hammer and the dance way back in March, which was by far the most accurate prognostication, other than yours, of course, as to how COVID would affect things going forward. Well, Tomas has written another article just a week or two ago in which he explains that most of the resurgence of COVID, whether it be in U.S. states or in countries around the world, is because of travel. And this article's, it's titled something like Build Fences. And so his point is that there is no way, even with a vaccine, that we're going to get control of this virus until we are very, very tight on letting people move across state boundaries in their countries and international boundaries, meaning quarantine. So I want to agree with you, but I think that, discretionary travel will be limited by regulation, and it will be limited by people being afraid to take the risk.
Art, let's switch to slide 3 in your deck now, which of course is the comparative inventory chart. Any new listeners that we may have who are not familiar with this concept of comparative inventory and Art's system for forecasting oil prices, which has been incredibly accurate over the years, I encourage you to go to our homepage at macrovoices.com, type Art Berman into the search page, and look for some of Art's first interviews on Macro Voices, where he describes and explains this comparative inventory system in detail. We're going to assume you understand the basics now. Art, as we take a look at slide 3, I'm kind of curious. It seems like there's a trend here that, the red curve, which was 2013, or I guess it was 2014 through June of 2017, that red curve really showed a lot of price sensitivity to inventory. You had a change in comparative inventory of just a few thousand barrels, and boy, it could really do a number on prices. Then in the blue curve from July of 2017 through 2018, the end of 2018, on that blue curve, it still was basically the same shape, but it was a lot less price sensitive to changes in inventory. Now it seems that we're into a new curve, a new yield curve, so to speak, which is the green one, 2019 and 20, that you have drawn in here. And it's showing even less price sensitivity to changes in comparative inventory. Why is that? What's going on here? And why is it that price is no longer as sensitive to comparative inventory as it used to be?
Well, it's a great question, Eric. And so, first of all, some people say, well, the fact that your yield curve, your curve fitting, if you will, changes means that that your method doesn't work. Well, okay, that's really kind of ridiculous, because the bond yield curves change. Yeah, of course they do. All these kinds of things change when the market reprices a commodity. It's just that simple. And so the red curve was, originated in a time when oil prices were super high. We're over $100 a barrel for several years back in 2011 through 2014. And so there was a lot of urgency. And that's what that steep curve says. It says the market perceives a lot of supply urgency. So, Libya goes offline, we lose 1 million barrels a day, and price of oil goes way up. All right. So then we go to the blue curve, and this is after the price collapse in 2014 through 16. And the world says, well, we don't feel quite the same sense of insecurity. And so, maybe something happens, like Galwar refinery gets bombed by whomever, Iranians or whoever. And what happened to the price of oil? It went up about $5 for a couple of days and then went back down. My goodness, if that would have happened in 2013, the price of oil would have gone to $200. Everybody would have said, oh my God, we're losing the biggest oil fields in the world. The price has got to go to the ceiling. No, in April, or I guess it was April of 2019 when that happened, price of oil went from, like 60 to 65 bucks, no big deal, because oil had been repriced and the market knew there's lots of spare oil out there. Well, once COVID came in and world demand dropped, the market repriced oil again. They said, now we feel even less insecure about what interruptions in supply might mean. And so, you know, and that works both ways. So in other words, when that curve has a flat slope, as it does right now, then you can change comparative inventory by a whole lot, and it doesn't change the price very much. And that's exactly what we're seeing.
I'm going to go back to my prior prediction. I'm very curious if you'd agree with me. And admittedly, this is all speculation at this point. But I think that when you get to the point, and clearly it's not now, it's sometime next year or later than next year, when you get to the point where you fully reopen the economy, let's say there is an effective vaccine, you can go back to everybody can fly as much as they want to and so forth. I think we go back to a slope probably close to where the red curve slope was. And the reason I say that is, you know, right now, let's face it, if you have a deficit of supply in Cushing, Oklahoma, which would normally worry people about upside in oil prices. Look, everybody knows that OPEC Plus has plenty of spare capacity. They've been fighting with each other about who's in compliance and who's not in compliance with the cuts they've agreed to. We all know that they could turn up the volume if they wanted to. If we get to a situation where you've still got a very low rig count and all of a sudden demand is increasing exponentially, and you know that there's that 11 to 12 month lag time for U.S. shale to catch up with demand, that's where I think you get back to that urgency. And everybody's saying, boy, if Cushing draws down, we don't know where we're going to get more oil to replace it. We got a problem, Houston. That to me suggests that we're headed back towards a much steeper slope when everything is fully reopened, not just partially reopened. Would you agree with that?
So, Eric, I agree with you notionally. Everything you said is perfectly logical. And the question where I have some reservation is whether or not we can, not whether we want to, whether we can get back to full oil consumption. And I say that because we are, I believe, near the end of a 50 or 60 year debt cycle. And for those of you that don't believe me, because I'm not an economist, you know, go read what Ray Dalio has for free on the changing world order on the internet. And he talks about this at considerable length and with far more authority than I have. But the point is that debt productivity has gone to very low levels, and the level of debt is so high that we're at a point where, you know, we just can't do much more to goose the economy by creating money. So looking at slide 13, this is a slide that is US, admittedly. Some people will chafe at that, but that's where the data is. And what this shows is really two things. It shows credit growth or negative growth. And it also shows something which is called the credit impulse. And the credit impulse is just the change in flow of credit compared to economic activity or GDP. And what we see in this graph, and it goes, you know, clear back to the 1960s. this covers the whole debt cycle, is that the big spike, the blue spike that's on the right, right underneath the text 2020, that was the positive credit impulse that has resulted from all the U.S. government spending since COVID. And that's the highest level of both credit impulse and credit growth, you know, in certainly decades. And now look what's happened in the second quarter. We've now gone to negative credit growth, one of the deepest negatives ever, if not the deepest. And we've gone to a very low level of credit impulse. And so what's happening, what this chart tells me, is that it's credit that runs the real economy. And what we can anticipate, at least in coming quarters, is there going to be a whole lot less credit available, because there already is, to get the economy back to where it needs to be. So that's, you know, this can change, and hopefully it does. But, you know, this is the data we have, and the data tells me that an economic recovery and an oil consumption recovery is not in the near-term cards. And you may be right, you know, that out there in 2021, all of this goes away, but I'm a little skeptical.
Art, I just want to compare the sentiment that you're expressing now, because it seemed to me in June like you were really kind of saying, hey, look, you know, not yet, but once we get to Q4, you know, prices are going straight up, baby. And now you're saying, I'm not sure we're going to get back to that full oil utilization. Now, I understand the logic of what you're saying, but how do I reconcile that with what I see in the EIA weekly data reports? Because frankly, we were for a while, there were a lot of builds and everything. Now we're seeing consistent drawdowns on inventory, you know, basically bullish signals, not super urgently bullish, but it seems like a trend is developing in the data that looks like it's, you know, a resumption of a bullish trend, which might take a while to play out, but it looks pretty bullish. On the other hand, you went from what felt to me like more bullish in June than you are now. What's going on? Is the comparative inventory model not accurately forecasting the same things that the EIA models are forecasting, or what?
Another good question, Eric. So first of all, yeah, we've had, you know, like 2 months of comparative inventory and crude oil and everything else, withdrawals, meaningful drawdown by any measure you want, you know, for, you know, every week. This past week, the report that came out today was about half the average, but, you know, the week before was one of the largest reductions. So all that's, you know, all that's very positive. But what's driving that? Okay. We've already discussed that consumption isn't driving that. And when I say consumption, I mean domestic U.S. consumption, which is a little different than demand because demand includes exports. And so what I would argue here is a couple of things are going on that if you look at, let's say, slide number four shows U.S. crude imports in red, exports in black, and net imports in the orange bars. And what you see is that net imports of crude oil have been decreasing consistently, pretty much, since the middle of June, since the last time we talked. Okay, so that means that we're importing less and exporting somewhat more. So this is driving the crude oil drawdowns. If we look at the next slide, which is five, it's the same kind of slide, except with refined product exports, imports, and nets. And so again, you know, it's mixed from week to week, but overall, petroleum product exports have come back pretty strong. So this is what is principally driving the drawdowns of crude oil and refined products, is that we're sending it overseas, either to places whose demand is stronger than ours, or, and this is key, to China. And I think what has changed in my thinking, it was in my thinking the last time we talked, but China has formed, you know, call it a buyer's club. You know, it's like Costco. It's like Walmart. And what China has done, China has driven the crude oil recovery by buying tons of everybody's oil at very cheap prices. And that is what drove prices back from, you know, the hubs of hell, you know, back up to $40 a barrel. It was largely the impulse of China buying. Well, China turns around and it dumps products on the world. And China's not alone in doing this. They've got their friends and neighbors. And so what's happening, I think, is this sort of colossal battle setting up between the world's producers, OPEC Plus, if you will, who have tried their best to dictate price to the market in one way or another now for 40 or 50 years, and the consumers of the world, the have-nots, who are mostly in Asia, who are saying, wait a minute, guys, we're the customers here. You don't care about us, and so we're going to control the price of oil by our flow with our cash of buying crude and exporting products. And so we had a very nice rally that got us up to WTI of something like, you know, $43, $44. And for no particular reason, it just went away. We went down below 40, at least no particular reason I could see other than sentiment. What was that sentiment about? That sentiment was about, oh my gosh, demand isn't recovering as quickly as possible. What was the root of that sentiment? China's not buying oil at the same rate they used to. So I think it's speculative right now to say that China has and its friends have effectively checked OPEC Plus. Not that OPEC Plus was hugely successful to begin with, but I think there's a force out there to be considered that is equally potent in controlling oil price. Price gets too high, they just stop buying crude and it goes back down.
Art, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. Before I let you go, though, I want to just remind our listeners, if you're not already subscribed to all of the terrific free content at artberman.com, if you want to see slides like these much more frequently, that's the place to get it. There's also a blog there. But Art, you've also expanded your services. When I first met you, you really only did consulting for, you know, producing oil companies. You help people drill oil wells and so forth. You weren't really offering services directly to investors. And that's changed in the last few years. Tell us a little bit more about your product offerings.
Sure, Eric. So I have a weekly offering. It's called Oil Comparative Inventory and Storage Report. Every week, I tell my subscribers what I'm telling you right now, only in much, much more detail and specific to this week's report. That's available for about $50 a month if you buy it on an annual basis. I do the same for natural gas, again, once a week, same price. And then for those that are a little bit more casual in their interest in investing in oil, I've got a newsletter and rig count subscription, which is about $200 a year. You know, that tells you every week the details of how the rig count is being distributed across the shale plays and other plays, and a monthly letter that summarizes my sense of where the market, the oil market's going. So those are all available. But you're right, everything else is completely free. You got to sign in, got to give me your login and a password, but it's absolutely free.
And our listeners can find more information about all of those services at artberman.com. Art, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back right after this message from our sponsor. Farmland investing has been a popular macro trend among billionaires and big institutions for the last decade. But the high cost of buying an entire farm put this asset class out of reach to all but big institutions and the ultra-rich. FarmTogether.com allows any accredited investor to invest in fractional ownership of several different categories of farmland. I recently did a full-length interview with FarmTogether.com founder and CEO, Artem Milinchuk. We discussed the macro argument for farmland investing, performance and correlation comparisons to conventional asset classes, and the different types of farmland and their investment characteristics. If you're an accredited investor, I recommend that you listen to that interview and learn why farmland investing might be a fit for your portfolio. You can find the download link in your Research Roundup email, or just type the word farmland into the search box on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Check out farmtogether.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was so great to have Art back on the show. It's always great to get an objective view on the oil markets, but I know that you have some additional opinions on crude. What's on your mind?
Well, Patrick, let's take a look at the November WTI futures chart in order to frame this discussion. Listeners, you'll find our post-game chart book linked in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads right above Art Berman's picture. As we look at this chart on page 2, we see, you know, the big sell-off all the way down Now, remember, this is the November contract. So even though the price of crude oil went all the way down to minus $37, that was isolated only to the May contract that went negative. The later contracts never got down, in this case, below about $24 was the low on the November contract. And it's recovered very briskly since then, right up into June. Art Berman, pretty much almost to the day, called the flattening out. And of course, the price did still continue to drift a little bit higher, but not at nearly the same precipitous rate that it was recovering through May and June. We had anticipated that there would be some kind of a sell-off or correction. Seems like that was beginning at the end of August, beginning of September, and it looked like, boy, it was much less than we thought. Now it looks to me like we really are headed back down. The correction is probably not over. I'm still targeting the low 30s for the short term in terms of this move. And as far as the longer term, I think at some point you definitely have a huge setup for a massive spike much higher in prices. That happens when economies around the globe get fully reopened, meaning that people feel comfortable traveling on airplanes, everybody is out and about and spending money. And my prediction is, and this is entirely speculation and conjecture on my part, but I think that this is going to take longer than most people expect before there's a vaccine that meaningfully changes anything. Eventually, we're going to get to the point where people have been cooped up for a couple of years and they don't care what the price of airfare is. They're going to go out and travel and spend money. And I think there's going to be a very brisk recovery in energy prices at some point. As Art described in this interview, I no longer think that that's necessarily going to happen in Q4 of this year, which was my original view. In fact, I think it's very unlikely that a big recovery in oil prices is coming in Q4. I think it's sometime in 2021, maybe the second half of 2021. At that point, by the end of 2021, I'll be surprised if we haven't touched at least $80 and maybe even $100 on WTI crude oil. But that would be if we get a full recovery of everything's back to normal. I'm not sure we're going to get a full recovery of everything's back to normal. Now, what Art said, the one place I disagree with him slightly, he said, look, maybe you're going to get the end of the crisis, but Art feels like we're at the end of a debt supercycle. I agree with him on that. But wait a minute. If we're at the end of a debt cycle, what that's going to mean is the shale patch is not going to be able to get the money they need to aggressively increase the rig count and increase U.S. production. And that's a setup for oil prices to really just make a moonshot to the upside. At least $80, maybe over $100 a barrel, I think, is coming on WTI when you get a full reopening of the economy sometime later. Well, what about between now and then? I think we're headed back down to somewhere between $30 and $33. The big question on my mind is, what hits the tape first? Are we going to have the expected fall off on U.S. production that Art predicted? Maybe that still happens in Q4 before we get any really deep, meaningful decrease in demand. In that case, I think it gets us up to new highs, maybe $45, $46, and maybe even upwards of $50 on WTI. On the other hand, if we see U.S. production continue to hold steady, but the demand situation continues to weaken as we move into the end of this year and early 2021, then I think potentially you get a sell-off down to $26 again, which was the previous low going back to 2015 or 2016. I think it was early 2016 was when we saw that $26 low. Strong technical level right there. I think it's actually 26.08. So I think there's scope for potentially this sell-off that's begun to continue all the way down to $26. But that's only if U.S. production continues to stay strong and demand continues to weaken. If U.S. production falls off before we get those confirmations of demand weakening, I think there's plenty of room for more upside. So it's hard to really tell which way we're going in the next 6 to 9 months. I think as you get in the 9 to 18 month horizon, there's a pretty strong argument for higher prices. But obviously, the further out you go, the less conviction you can have. And we'll have to revisit those predictions as we get into the middle of 2021. Meanwhile, Patrick, I do want to focus on the green box that you added to this chart. I assume what you're highlighting there is the volume profile in that green box. Well, gee, we got a breakdown below that green box just on today's candle in the chart. From a technical analysis perspective, what does that tell you as the technician in the house?
Right. Well, I mean, it's convenient that that also lines up where that big gap happened to occur on at least this November contract, which also lied around this $40 area. For me, the narrative was like, we had this big drop in September and we had a bounce, and the bounces are very natural. But in order for me to already be thinking that a new bull phase was underway, you wanted to see the price action beat something more than just a little Fibonacci bounce on the upside. So far, it was really a 3-4 day rally in early September, and it just rolled right over and we're back down below there. That becomes now a key overhead resistance level. And right now, just very similar to what you're talking about, the likelihood that we still see a little more weakness coming down into the mid to low 30s on this November contract, in my mind, is entirely possible. The areas to watch are the Fibonacci zones down in the $32 to $34 area, possible place where we could be heading if this does accelerate on the short term. I remain optimistic or bullish the energy market over the longer term, but it may just mean that going into the elections, into like November, December, oil may end up doing a lot of chop here and backfilling a lot of that rally off of the April lows.
I agree, Patrick, and I think there's a lot of uncertainty, because if you get the weakening demand from maybe a breakdown in economics and lowering demand expectations because of the contested election and the other things that are going on, yeah, definitely low 30s easy, and maybe in an extreme case, 26. On the other hand, if Art's original prediction about U.S. shale production really falling off a cliff in Q4, if that materializes, and you know, now Art's hedging a little bit, saying maybe at the end of Q4 or even into the beginning of 2021. Well, if that happens at the beginning of Q4, let's say, you know, during the month of October, if we go from 10.7 down to 8.7 million barrels of U.S. production, I think we're back above $50 pretty quickly. So I could see this going either way from here, Patrick, but let's move on to page 3, S&P 500. What do you see in this chart, and what should investors think about what's coming next?
Well, first of all, page 3 is a chart in the past. We're looking at the 2018 Christmas massacre sell-off. And I wanted to put context on this, because when we look at what we've been going through over the last 5 or so trading sessions, is the stock market has been backfilling the initial market correction. And a lot of people have this question, was that it? I mean, could the market just start to rally from here? Is it all over? Or is there more selling to come? And what I felt was relevant about the late 2018 market correction, which started in September of 2018, was it started in a similar fashion. It started with an 11% market correction that happened over 18 trading sessions, and then we bounced. And the market bounced and retraced more than half of the prior sell-off. And it lasted for the rally lasted for 6-7 days in a row. But really, what we ended up just seeing was over a month of just chop back and forth, whipping down, whipping back up. And then it ended with some very aggressive selling that ended up making this entire market correction one of those 20%+ drops that lasted almost 3 months in total duration. And I feel that this is an interesting roadmap. While the market will never correct the same way twice, it's an interesting roadmap or thought process of what would it look like if the current market correction played out that way. And so when we go to page 4, we can see that this drop that we've gone through since the early September top was that we've gone through 14 trading sessions and 11% correction. And since then, we've been now going on this like 5 days of market rallying off of the low, but we're not even 50% retraced the drop. And so the question I'm asking, you know, is there enough evidence to say that a legitimate short-term bottom is in? I don't think so. I think the market here is still highly vulnerable, that once this reflexive bounce off of that oversold condition finishes, the market is still vulnerable for at least another trip back down to the low. And if the elections add some new additional volatility, which is entirely possible, that trip still down to 3,000 on the S&P is entirely on the table in my mind.
Well, Patrick, as I said in the market wrap at the beginning of the show, if there's a way to figure this out and kind of get an idea of what's coming, it's to figure out the U.S. dollar first. Let's move on to page 5. You're looking at the dollar against the euro. Now, looks like we've got a pretty clear head and shoulders pattern here. What's this tell you?
Right. So let's go back to the title of the whole presentation, which is that, is the reflation trade over? And one of the greatest drivers, or the largest precipitating driver of a reflation narrative, is a bearish dollar. And we typically will see a dollar declining. And the byproduct of that is all the cross currencies are doing very well. And more importantly, all the commodity markets are doing very well, which drives an inflationary impulse and gets all of that start being priced in. And so what's interesting is there's no shortage of technicians out in FinTwit that are observing the head and shoulders or rounding top. They all call it a different thing, but ultimately it's a period where the euro has paused that advance. And really the question that we're asking, was that a legitimate top? Because what's interesting about corrections is often simply a natural zigzag wedge correction in a prior rise can often be deceptively, from a technical perspective, look like a head and shoulders pattern. And we're such at a critical moment, an important crossroad to determining whether or not this dollar move is legitimate. And one of the biggest things for all of our Macro Voice listeners to be watching in the coming week or two is, will the euro fail to beat 118 on the upside? I mean, if we can see the euro beat 118 and get back into that range of where the topping formation was in the 119 range, give or take, then that kind of neutralizes this topping formation. And then we have to really actually table the idea that the dollar sell-off may not be over. At the same time, if we see by early next week that this is rolled right over and we're heading to 116 or lower on the euro, that basically, you can start grabbing a handful of nails to put in the coffin on the euro bull trade. And that, I think, is going to be one of the single biggest things to watch.
Well, Patrick, another aspect of this reflation trade is commodity prices. We've seen a pretty significant rally in a lot of commodities, including copper, going back to, you know, the March lows as the coronavirus crisis was kind of bottoming out. It seems like we've broken the trend line here on page 6 of the chart book. What does that tell you?
Right. And so it's interesting because we were talking about the crude oil chart, and crude oil is the most important commodity to watch from an impact on inflation. But copper is also a really good bellwether you can kind of keep an eye on. And some people are saying that this was influenced by the Chinese holiday. But to me, it's no coincidence that this break is happening in line with when we're seeing the dollar strength and weakness in a lot of other commodities. And so to me, with the fact that the copper is breaking down here, oil's breaking down, it's going to really continues to support the idea that at least a minimum, we've paused the reflation trade. And more importantly, the one big thing to ask is that, is it actually legitimately over, where for several months, we may just be backfilling all of these prior rallies that have been in place since March?
Moving on to page 7, you've got silver as opposed to gold to represent the precious metals complex here in this reflation discussion. Why silver?
Well, you know, I just think that we talk gold so much and we've covered it in the market wrap that I figured we'd just take a look at its little cousin. And what's interesting is that sell-off in silver, which was pretty aggressive on the downside, stalled pretty much right at the 61.8 retracement of its summer rally. And often it brings in buy signals and turns things around. But this is the same sort of storyline on the upside towards $25, the same way the euro is in terms of a move back toward 118. While we certainly have bounced from a very oversold condition, I think as early as next week's show, we're going to start to see whether or not this was just a bounce bounce or whether there was a legitimate short-term trading bottom that was established here. And so I'm watching this as to whether silver can actually put something together north of 25. But the longer we stay just consolidating down below here, there might still be one more trip lower in the commodity.
And to give us a broader perspective on commodities, we've got the Bloomberg Commodity Index on slide number 8. And boy, that really is looking like at the end of August there, like maybe a top and the beginning of a new trend with a series of, you know, lower highs and lower lows.
Well, that's exactly it. And this is the single biggest puzzle piece, like you were saying earlier, was the dollar. What it's going to come down to is, has the dollar established a short-term bottom? And are we going to see a U.S. dollar that strengthens into the elections? I think that commodities will have a very hard time to buck the trend that the dollar establishes. And I think that's going to be the one key thing to watch through all of this. And that's definitely what I'm going to be keeping my eye on. But one of the things I wanted to really show on page 9 was the 30-year break-evens. And so this really shows where the market is anticipating inflation. And obviously, when the dollar peaked, we saw that at the same time that corresponded with where the lows on these inflation expectations came in that early March. And since then, the 30-year break-evens have been an upwards pattern. What's interesting is that we put in that high last month on this, and right now we're trading more or less, or at least attempting to bounce down up to about the 1.78 on these 30-year break-evens. And one of the key things I'm going to be watching is, when do the markets start to price in the commodity correction? Because I think that if the crude oil and copper and all of these other commodities continue the trends that were established this week, then we will start to see this reflect in these break-evens. And I think that's the one thing to keep a very close eye on.
Well, Patrick, thanks for another terrific post-game chart book. Listeners, if you want to get a similar chart book from Patrick every single day instead of just once a week, be sure to check out his service, Big Picture Trading. The information for getting a free trial of that service is on page 10 of your chart book or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by farmtogether.com. Making farmland investing a $1 trillion asset class available to all accredited investors. And by toptradersunplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Art Berman's slide deck and the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame. There's also a link to a Variant Perception blog on the ECB's focus shifting to bank lending, as well as a link to Jesse Felder's article, It's Time to Get Greedy in the Energy Sector. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.